I've assigned readers the first 3 days for the Beatitudes. Is there someone who would be willing to do that reading for us today? Just a volunteer. So again, I invite you to just take a breath and relax and breathe your way into this space.
When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up the mountain. And after he sat down, his disciples came to him. Then he began to speak and taught them, saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they will be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they will receive mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven.
Each of our conversations stands alone, so if you haven't been here before, no worries. But just to bring us to where we are, if you have been, I'm just going to say each of those, and we're going to introduce the beginning of each one. And I invite you don't have to raise your hands. I know that's hard for Lutherans to go out of order, but retrieve your inner confidant. And just say briefly, in a few words or one sentence, nothing elaborate, nothing really explanatory, but just in a few words, how each of these now strike you. Okay? Blessed are the poor in spirit. Okay? Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you. How he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you have been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. Any first responses to that? Wow.
What troubles you?
Okay.
as a suburban white boy, middle class, that didn't have any problems growing up. There's a lot of you must before you must. But if you, I think you can be kind before you've known terrible sorrow. I think it can be a gift to you or talk to you or... I think you could probably do better at kindness if you do these things, but I don't think anyone can tell someone else you can't be kind until you've suffered. Although Jesus tells us we have to pick up our cross. But, so that...
I was thinking it was more, not the giver of kindness, but the receiver. That you can't know really what that kindness, how valuable it is until you've reached that low. That's how I was hearing it.
As a fairly recent widow, I have certainly been to the depths and felt and received the kindness of others. And I understand kindness now in a way that I didn't before.
You didn't know kindness before that?
Yes, I did.
But it has a different shape.
But it's different now.
And it is. Me easier to reach out. I'm more likely to follow my instinct and act in a way that's kind to other people as a result of that.
You had more limits and numbers.
Yeah. It strikes me that in those times in my life when I have not been able to laugh or sing, and I know I'm at the lowest point, and the simple kindness of friends who reach out allows you to do those simple tasks like tying your shoe or going to the store and being able to do it fully instead of just trying to survive.
I'm struck by the line, where is it, it says, and he has plans. You have plans.
Which line is
it? You must travel where this Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he too was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. In our city, we've had kind of an extraordinary number of young African-American men shot and killed in this year, and you hear from the families afterwards that they don't want them clumped into some sort of group and dismissed as though this was, well, they were a member of a gang, or, oh, they had been drinking, or, oh, this, and as though then that wasn't a life, and these little one of the accidents happened very near our home, and this little memorial that was still there when we packed to come here, these flowers and balloons and teddy bears that kind of were on the curb in the neighborhood to kind of remember and kind of bring story to that and to this outpouring of the community to honor, and the moms and dads and grandmas wanting there to be a story there, and that's what strikes me in that corner. And they had plans, that life that was there.
What does it mean to be kind?
To give of yourself?
To be present with the other?
To love someone as you love yourself.
To listen.
To suppress the evil within you.
sometimes it's risk. Take a risk.
I think often kindness can be a risk.
I didn't hear that.
She said it's a risk. She thinks sometimes it's a risk, and I think often it is. Are we in a culture that rewards kindness?
No.
Or even expects it? Do you tend to expect kindness from someone you don't know?
Yes.
No.
Yes. Yeah. Ah, some yeses and some noes.
I think we expect niceness, which is very
I think it comes in many shapes and forms. I don't think there's any one, this is kindness, this is what it is. So it could be as simple as saying hello to a neighbor, you know, on a regular basis to make them feel like they're part of the community versus giving money to a charity or paying someone's grocery bill or something. It could be many things.
Or leaving $3 in the book for ice cream.
Exactly.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Kindness is one of the words that used to be used for mercy. Not used so much anymore, I think, because we have mixed up kindness and niceness. And are not always sure we know what mercy is anymore. So, let's just take a second and look and hear what Jesus has to say about mercy. Chapter 9, verse 13 of Matthew. Actually, we'll start at verse 10. As he sat at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher sit with tax collectors and sinners?" But when he heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice." And then, not long later, chapter 12, he's there again with, this time, plucking grains on the Sabbath. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry, and they began to pluck heads of grain and to eat. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath." He said to them, "Have you not read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God and ate the bread of the presence, which it was not lawful for him or his companions to eat, but only for the priests. Or have you not read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temples break the Sabbath and yet are guiltless? I tell you, something greater than the temple is here. But if you had known what this means, 'I desire mercy and not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the guiltless." I desire mercy and not sacrifice. Gives them a glimpse. So, what do you think it means? I desire mercy, not sacrifice. If we put it in that context, with Jesus continually saying that to one Pharisee after another.
To reach out to those in need without getting caught up in rules and regulations.
Okay. Yeah.
Or without condemning and judging. I mean, it's so easy to be in a soup kitchen and feel good because you're handed out bread, but know that you would never sit and eat with that person in their house. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that concept of kindness reaches past the giving without having sincere empathy for that person.
Mm-hmm.
To understand and feel real sympathy and fellow humanity for someone who has, on some level, stepped outside the lines.
Yeah. Empathy, sympathy.
I'm having trouble with the word because usually I hear it, and I have a Czech Greek word, but I hear it like, "Please be merciful." Like, I deserve punishment. I deserve it. Be merciful to me.
You hear it as a plea.
Pardon. Yeah, it's a plea. It's a begging. I don't think it probably means that.
compassion, pity, that those are the words that are listed in the text for the Greek word for mercy here.
You know, though,
it also goes back to Hesed.
I have one thing that Geneva Bible helped me with, French. It's blessed are the debonair.
We talked about debonair yesterday, actually.
And that was mentioned at the beginning yesterday. Yeah. That's a sense of not of what you do, but what you are. I think of Fred Astaire, who's given a lot of mercy.
I think it was a time when religion had, for people, become something they could institutionalize, and the sacrifice was at least partly alluding to what went on in the temple every day. These thousands of animals that were sacrificed and the blood running in gutters, and the Pharisees were in charge of it, and he was saying, it's time to get rid of this institutionalized religion and have it be religion of your daily life and how you treat people. It's part of it is a simple reform.
From Hebrews chapter 2. Therefore, he had to become like his brothers and sisters in every respect, so that he might be a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God. He had to become like his brothers and sisters in every respect. Incarnation is mercy. In this poem.
The men's group had gathered food and toys at Christmas time, and they got the name of this family where the man was unemployed, and so they had put some bells on their car and were sounding like Santa Claus coming. And they came up to the door and said, we'd like to bring you some gifts. And the man said, no, please don't. And they said, it's Christmas. We want to give you these gifts. Please don't. And so they left the gifts and the food on the porch. That night, the man committed suicide. To be kind is to be responsive to where the other person is at. When we think we know what they need and we're going to meet their needs, we have imposed ourselves on them and often don't really hear them and don't relate to them.
You referred to what the Greek word is that's used here. The Greek word that's used here is eleos. And it means, at its deepest sense, it's more than an act. I mean, an act or a sacrifice or a ritual is one thing. The basics of eleos are acts that get inside the life of another, that help you to inhabit the life of another as part of your walk with them. You use the word empathy, being able to stand in the other person's shoes. And sympathy, at its most basic core, the root words of sympathy, syn, S-Y-N, to join together with, and pakein, to suffer. Sympathy is to join together with in suffering. So to be merciful, at the root of the word, is to be able to walk in the other person's shoes. To be able, one of you said, see, something just complimented on the things I was holding in my head, and now I'm not holding them. To be able to know and to feel the common humanity. To be able to know that not only has that person perhaps stepped outside the lines, but you know what, you might too. And to know what that feels like. In this poem, it talks about, you must see how this could be you. You must see how this could be you. That's the root of mercy in this word and in this moment. You must see how this could be you. Now, blessed are the merciful. Blessed are those who can see themselves in the shoes of others. The person that I think of most, and you mentioned him the other day, Any of you, and I think you must be familiar with him, because I think he started out here, Cardinal Bernardine from Chicago.
Yes.
Yeah. Cardinal Bernardine was accused of sexual misconduct by a young man in the Chicago area, and put himself through the same process that his priest went through and all of that, and the man later recanted. He was dying and he recanted. This man never did this to me. And it seemed fairly clear that it hadn't happened in this case. This was a case of a true false accusation. Cardinal Bernardine put himself in the shoes of the other man. He befriended the other man. He became understanding of what had happened to that man to bring him to the point to make such an accusation. Walked with that young man on his journey to God. He was merciful. He could have been vengeful. You said...
suppressing the evil within.
Suppressing the evil within us. It's looking at a moment or a person or a time or a place when you have the opportunity to get back at it. Right? Ah, the taste of revenge. And instead, you looked in their shoes, you've looked in their life, you've inhabited who they are and where they are from, and instead, you choose to be merciful. You choose to walk in their shoes. Now, why on earth would we do that? Why would you do that?
Because God has done it for us.
Yeah, and who was saying it?
To bring peace.
To bring peace to yourself.
It's what the kingdom looks like.
It's what the kingdom looks like. It's how you bring peace to yourself. But if we read this at a very basic level, because it's what God does for us. Really. The Hebrew word that leads to mercy, that's used most often in the Old Testament, is chesed. And the word mercy is used something like 200 times throughout the scriptures. Chesed usually describes God. It describes how God acts, how God is in relation to people. All the ways in which God offers mercy instead of judgment. Offers a moment of kindness. Slow to anger and abounding in steadfast love. In Genesis 19, the story of Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah and the destruction of Sodom, the word mercy is used when the angels come to get Lot and take him out of the village. You know, it's about to be destroyed, this is all going down, and Lot's refusing to leave. And the angels, it says, the angels being merciful took him by the hand and led him away from the danger. I like that image, that they could have left him there. You could leave anyone to the evil that they've done, but instead they take them by the hand and lead them from the danger. That's become for me an image of mercy. And if we go back to those Hebrew texts where mercy is constantly used to describe God's actions toward us, and the people of God gathered on that mountain know that's what God is merciful. And all of a sudden you have Jesus saying, blessed are those of you who are merciful. Same word as what we've used to talk about God. Blessed are the merciful, for you will receive mercy. For you will receive mercy. Do you remember the story of the unforgiving servant? Later in Matthew. The thing about Matthew is he takes each of these and he fleshes them out throughout the book. They are woven into the rest of the text. Who can give me the basics of the story of the unforgiving servant? Who remembers that? Yeah.
Okay, this might be really basic.
Yeah, it's fine.
I just know that there's a man who owes a great debt and to a king or someone like that, someone in power, and he's brought to that man. He could be either put to death or some very harsh punishment, his debt is forgiven. And I don't remember what the king or person of power says to him as he goes out, but it might be to like go and do likewise or something, but he might not say anything. Anyway, he's forgiven, off he goes, and he comes upon a man who owes him a much smaller debt. And he, I can't remember exactly what he does to that man, but basically he has him arrested, or he is very unkind to him, even though his own much greater debt has just been forgiven.
And the king says to him, "You wicked slave, I forgave you all your debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow slave as I had mercy on you?" And in his anger, his Lord handed him over to be tortured until he would pay his entire debt. So my Heavenly Father will also do to every one of you if you do not forgive your brother and sister from your heart. Instead of giving in to vengeance, instead of grabbing the guy that you see on the throat by the throat of the street, when you've just been shown mercy, you are, in the very strong words of this parable, demanded to show mercy to others, because it has been shown to you, because God has given you chesed, because God has given you mercy, because God has led you away from evil. You have to do the same. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us or sin against us. It is, for me, a hard thing to grasp, that because we're Lutheran, right, and we don't want to rely too much on works, but mercy requires us to be merciful. Mercy requires us to step into another person's shoes, to walk as they have walked before, you use the word judgment, to have empathy, to do as Christ did in that Hebrews passage, to walk and you inhabit the heart of someone else before we crush them. And when we do that, when we take the time to do that, we can see them with God's eyes. It slows down our prejudices, it slows down our fears, it slows down all of those things that would have us instead act in ways of evil.
So isn't that, as Lutherans, we believe it works, are a grateful response to the mercy that God has given us.
And it is actually the perfect, yeah.
It's just you're so grateful, you can't believe that you've been so gracefully forgiven and shown mercy that works flows easily up.
So I have a question.
Okay.
I think of mercy as a lot like agape love.
Okay.
Unconditional, because you don't always have the opportunity to get to know in depth someone that you may have at a basic level of prejudice against. You can say, "I'm not prejudiced," but unless you have time to invest in their life and their history to know them, it just has to be agape love, unconditional.
Well, this is what Tom was alluding to. Tom indicated there were a lot of musts in here, that you must wake up with sorrow, you must speak to it, to your voice. That's the leap between the two. That, you know, maybe you don't know all the sorrow and suffering, but the love that you have been given and shown in a God who would take the same form as you pushes your heart to show the same love, the same mercy.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
My husband, Terry, had really terrible parents and was raised, we were both raised not in the Lutheran church, but parents that were not the kind of people that you probably all are. And there was a conversation it was really bad for Terry and his sister. And there was a conversation with a friend of ours who said, "Well, if your father was here now, what would you say to him?" And Terry paused and said, "May the Lord have mercy on his soul." And it was just such a surprising answer, because the expected answer would be, you know, why did you do all these terrible things to us? And, you know, why couldn't you have seen us instead of, as your children, instead of yourself? And to come that far and say that, I just think it's so nice, or not, you know, not nice is the right word, but it's just so, like, he's getting in for sure. He's only checking in.
Well, it's not a throwaway line. It's a plea. Yeah. May God have mercy on your soul. May God have mercy. May God show you the same kindness and love and generosity that God has shown me.
Mercy doesn't negate the, it's the same as forgiveness, it doesn't negate the ill.
Nope.
It doesn't just say, well, that's, I mean, which is kind of this thing that we do culturally. You say, well, I'm really sorry I did that, so that's okay, or just forget it. But it's not. It, instead, it says, I can see you, I can see me in you. And in spite of the things you have done, I'm still willing to walk beside you or to reconnect the relationship. So there's more of an embracing of the brokenness rather than pretending it didn't exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very practical for me. What does it mean to walk in another's shoes? I was visiting a middle-aged woman who was very sick and could possibly die. And I went to pray with her and prayed for her healing, that she might recover and be fully well again. And as I prayed, she got more and more agitated as I prayed. And I finally realized that I was not asking for what she wanted. That somehow death was an answer for her at this point. So what I became aware of, if we're going to walk in other shoes, before we pray specifically for their life, we need to ask people, for what do you want me to pray? And that to me is a critical question when we pray with people.
I have a thought that comes to mind, and I have a hard time reconciling this with what you're talking about is, for example, the man who is on trial for killing both his parents and pleads for mercy because he's an orphan.
Or, I abused you because I was once abused. Right?
Yeah.
Shakespeare wrote that mercy seasons justice. That mercy and justice are, they cohabit, but justice doesn't go out the window. And that we are called, this is my interpretation of the text and such, that it is merciful to call the oppressed to courage, and to call the oppressors to account.
Can you say that again?
It's merciful to call the oppressed to courage and the oppressors to account. When we call someone to account for what they've done, we're not throwing mercy out the window. We're demanding mercy, not just for the present, but for the future, the victims, the others.
It also recognizes that justice can be twisted. It becomes almost as oppressive. I mean, mercy would recognize that this person is oppressing, but I could be oppressing just as easily. I can overthrow the landowners and then step into their place.
It's
so
it's
not always just a
there are a couple of lawyers and judges that are in the room, right? People who know law, I'm guessing that. It's a difficult thing to navigate, the whole justice and mercy thing, right? To navigate what is an appropriate, wise use of kindness.
Actually, try to eliminate it.
Yeah.
I mean, with the sentencing guidelines, trying to take discretion away.
Take that out. Take it out. Yeah.
I was in my second year of seminary on 9/11. And so I had a 9 o'clock class, which was on the spiritual practices of the Desert Fathers. So I entered that class while everyone is watching the TV and the towers are falling. And what we were talking about that day, and we went ahead and talked about it, was that in the writings of several of the Desert Fathers,
you're very kind.
Thank you. You have to be able to imagine yourself doing the act that someone else has done before you can forgive them. And likewise, you have to imagine yourself doing the act that someone has done before you can fully condemn them. Otherwise, you're ignorant in your condemnation. And if you can fully imagine yourself doing the act that someone else has done, you can't condemn them, because if you can put yourself utterly in their shoes, you have embraced the act of forgiveness, which kind of answers that question, that if, which doesn't mean that they shouldn't be punished, but if we're making decisions about condemnation or forgiveness, we have to utterly put ourselves, imagine ourselves, we have to imagine ourselves, flying an airplane into the Twin Towers. And when we can put ourselves in that place and imagine that, then in the very act of condemning,
so in that case, would it be also getting in touch with what it meant to be victims of our power, the capitalistic power and the military power, which is what they attacked, and they were responding to have been impacted by our use of power?
Well, we start to delve into some of what Jason's talking about, right? Sin and cycles of sin, and where we have choice and where we don't have choice, and we start to talk about systemic and all of those understandings of where the brokenness in our world and in ourselves lies. What it is to be human is not just powerfully wonderful and full of mystery, it also has some darkness. And can we step into and understand the darkness that might have motivated another, and then forgive, and then walk with, and then be kind, and then be merciful. And that may look differently in different situations. It may be wise in one situation to walk away. It may be wise in the next situation to stand firm and stare at the darkness in the face. And that may be the merciful moment. Mercy shown to us shapes us, right? If someone has shown you mercy, it's going to shape and change. It's going to affect, whether it's God who has shown you mercy or another, it's going to affect how you grow and how you take your next step. Whether that's as a community or as an individual. And the same is true if somebody doesn't show you mercy. That will shape and affect you as well. So if we're talking about a people who know mercy and know that they are called to it and begin to be shaped in that. We're talking about people who are on a journey of growing in that mercy, growing in their response to what they have been given. And that's part of what's happening in the pure of heart. When we say the word pure, what I mean, it's a There's no Greek complications to this word at all. What do you mean by pure? Untainted. 100% of what it should be. There's no 99 and 44 one-hundredths. It is 100%. Pure is untainted. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Comes from, Jesus is referring back to, a psalm. A psalm where David, you know, psalms are attributed to David, where David says, who will ascend the hill of the Lord? Who gets to be in God's presence? Who will stand in his holy place? Those who have clean hands and pure hearts, who do not lift up their souls to what is false, and do not swear deceitfully. Those who have clean hands and pure hearts. Now, do any of you have clean hands and pure hearts? Are any of you at the 100%? Somebody cackle. Okay. No, probably not. Most of us are not. So what would this be about? Can you be pure heart? Yeah.
Just reflect on that a moment, if you would. I always struck by that, cutting this relationship between the pure in heart and King David, who anything but a pure man. Mm-hmm. And yet God referred him to, in effect, as having a pure heart. Obviously, there's a spiritual quality here that's quite divorced from his difficult actions in his life.
Yeah, David was not always the greatest of guys. Yeah. And he is lifted up as this figure. I mean, we have all kinds of flawed people in texts lifted up as these figures, which we are called to emulate and learn from. What does it mean to have a pure heart? I'm going to just skip ahead a little bit because we're running a little long here. A pure heart has to do with motives, motivation. What motivates you? What pushes you? Now, the Jews, remember, were exiled. And all of those purity laws that they would have known about what you can eat, what you can drink, and who you can associate with, and the different, you know, like four categories of purity laws, and what makes you clean and what makes you unclean, and how you get from this column to this column. Those came out of exile. Those came out of needing to set themselves apart and know who was good and clean and pure and who wasn't. Who was in and who was out. Who was truly who they should be. Okay? One of the things that gets attached to pure in heart is that it is a means of us trying to figure out our way out of our own exile. Our own exile, whether you look at it from Eden or our inability to see God. The cloud that hovers and makes us incapable of seeing and fully knowing God. Some people refer to this as the mystic's beatitude. That this is the beatitude that relishes and longs for union with God. Somebody brought up Mother Teresa the other day and about how she had struggled. Mother Teresa had a mystical experience when she was young. She experienced union with God. She saw God and spent the rest of her life in a single-minded focus and devotion to return to that, to see God again. Pure in heart essentially means that you are single-minded in your pursuit of God, that you are not conflicted, that you are 100% from your core, because remember, the heart wasn't just this beating muscle. The heart was the center of who you were. The heart was where your motives and your motivation came from. The heart was the core of your being. And it was where you made your choices. We might call it the gut. Okay? And the pure in heart is the one whose heart is not confused. It is not conflicted. It is not 50% here and 30% there and 20% there. The pure in heart is the one who is 100% in pursuit of God. Single-minded in pursuing God as their motive and their motivation for what they do. That heart, that core, that center of who they are is 100% devoted to seeking God. Now, have any of you ever done anything with a pure 100% motivation? If you have, we will move you toward the front of the line for sainthood right away. You don't even have to die to get there. We're just going to put you right there up front. But as you said earlier, you know, you're in the food line, and all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I'm pretty good. Look what I'm doing. Or we talked yesterday a little bit about self-righteousness and how being righteous can very easily fall over into being self-righteous. Damn, I'm great. What a good sermon. What a good thing I just did. Our motives are very rarely pure, and if you look throughout the text, you'll find that that's the case for almost everybody that we see who pursues and follows God. But it's the one who is 100% dedicated to that pursuit. Occasionally, things fall off. God shows us mercy. But we pray that God's will be done, and we seek to pursue that. Remember the story of the two sons who are told by their father to go do something? Jesus had great stories. Go do this, and the first son says, okay. And the other son says, no way, and then goes back and does it. Which one is the purer of heart? The one with the better motive. The one who is more actively seeking to pursue the will of his father. Or the young man. The young man comes to Jesus and says, in Matthew, it's a young man. It's not somebody trying to trip Jesus up. Comes to Jesus and says, what must I do to inherit the kingdom of heaven? And Jesus says, go sell everything that you have. And he stands there divided, right? Broken heart. He has this longing, but now he's told he has to do this. It's not 100%. There's a confused heart, a divided heart. And while we can never reach 100%, on our good days, we tip to the pure side. On our good days, we tip to the pure side. On our bad days, well, then we come back to asking for mercy and promising that we'll give it to others. But this is a beatitude that's about motivation. About praying regularly, thy will be done. Praying regularly that your heart might be 100% pure, in tune with God's. And praying regularly that as a result of that pursuit of purity, that pursuit of being in tune with God, like we talked about yesterday, that you might see God. Timbers get pulled from your eyes, fog lifts, you might here and there see God. Does that make sense? Does that sound easy? So far, do any of these sound particularly easy?
No. Is that why Jesus needed to die?
Oh, you're getting into the needed to die piece. For which I'm going to say, I think it's 9:59, and they should be speaking at 10:15. Or 10:50. Jason will talk about the needed to die piece at some point. The other word for pure in heart, just to take this with you and chew on, is integrity. What good is it if your heart is pure and your intentions are right and good if it never comes out of your hands? A person who is pure in heart is one whose actions and words and self are all in alignment. And that might be easier for us to consider than being pure. Because I don't think there's one of us in the room who would claim that title. So think of it as integrity. Blessed are those whose actions and heart and mind and spirit are all in you. And we've known people, you've met people, that you meet and you go, who they are doesn't quite match who they claim to be. And you go back to the Pharisees. Desire mercy, not sacrifice. Go back to the Pharisees who are sacrificing just to get the law done. There's a woe later in Matthew where he talks about, you all are getting this all, you know, the outside of the vessel is clean and the plates are clean and everything is right there with the ritual purity, but you've got to fix things inside first. Who you are and how you are have to have integrity. The pure in heart are those who have integrity. The pieces fit together. Last word from anyone? Go in peace.
Oh, go ahead. I just wanted to say that what you've been saying hits to my heart. But I worry about the people that don't know the Lord and are looking in. And we talk about pureness of heart and integrity and the actions, like you said. I just really feel that. But I worry about sometimes the message that we give to non-believers. Because I hear that, oh, you're holier than thou, or you think you're better than us. And I think that's where the actions and the life you live melds with that.
I think people recognize people who are pure in heart, people who have integrity, people whose lives and beliefs and actions match what comes out their hands.
Yeah.
And I'm with you. I'm worried that frequently the church does not live that. The long for the motivation never gets to the hands. How long have we said all are welcome and not truly meant it? My first interim church, it's a silly example, but my first church out of seminary, the pastor had walked out the Sunday before, and the bishop called me and said, "You graduated last week, right? Okay, you can come out here on weekends till we get your real call." And so he walked out during communion the week before, and I showed up the next week.
Wow.
And
wow.
That was a story. And they were wounded. They still, to this day, are wounded by the actions of that man, who had preached to them grace, who had preached to them joy, who had preached to them hope, who had walked with them on their journeys. And then in the middle of this meal that represented all of those good gifts of God, walked out on them. His actions and his motivations did not match. And it can wound not only those who are in our pews, but those who are outside of them and looking in the door. Look at you. And see how it doesn't match. I think it's a terribly important thing.
What I meant by my question is, as I deal with every one of the Beatitudes, I end up hopeless. I can't do that. And that's what leads me to the death of Christ, because in the death of Christ, I die with him, and I rise to the hope that maybe my life can come to life in each of the Beatitudes.
And they are not there. This is a journey. Right? This is a journey. It's a journey of joy. Go in peace, serve the Lord.
Amen. Thanks be to God.